everyone, and welcome to This Nintendo Life, episode 254. And I definitely didn't just in that time slowly say it so that I could give myself the opportunity to open the document and see that the number was correct.
I wrote it in this time. I did you the favor.
Didn't leave me hanging. So I have, correct and accurate information all the time, as per usual. I'm NBZ. Hello, I'm a man on the internet who talks about video games. I'm joined by Bally. You're also a man on the internet who talks about video games.
Yes, I was just thinking that Guillaume at RFN, I think he's like currently trying to work out like his intro line, because you know Gregor says ahoy hoy. Mm-hmm, and I'm like, what could I say?
What is your intro, Bally?
My intro should be just like the art of Bally.
The art of Bally.
Simple, you know? Yeah. I don't know. That doesn't really reference anything in the moment, whereas ahoy hoy is like a form of hello, and just, I don't know.
It's a Simpsons reference directly.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yes. I think, that's definitely, you could take a reference from another piece of media that you love, Bally, but
goodness.
I don't know, opening a show being like the art of Bally.
It would be something lame like hello there. Being like Obi-Wan or something.
Yeah, you know, I think that works though.
Bally Jr.'s got a t-shirt and the t-shirt just says, hello there.
Yep. Or you open every episode just saying, yup, like Bobba in Attack of the Clones. That's how we open it. For sure. We're here. We're talking video games and we're busy. Bally's busy doing things. I'm busy doing things. And I'm going to be off to Germany very soon to Cologne, the Cologne Messe in Germany for Gamescom. Very fun time. But because of that, I'm not going to be here next time to record an episode. So, Bally, it's time to pull the ripcord, finally. We have had a little bonus prepared for a long time, where myself, Bally, and good friend of the show, Matt Lorigan, talk about Metroid Prime Federation Force. And that will be the episode that you get next time. So instead of a regular episode, it will be us discussing, quite frankly, one of my favorite games I've played this year, Metroid Prime Federation Force.
Those with eagle ears will notice that we did talk about it in our episode 250. So we have shared some opinions on that game. But if you want the full deep dive, we cover it next episode.
We go absolutely deep dive on it. Yeah, we talk about the whole game and all the stuff going on with it and its history. And it's a really good episode. I'm very excited for people to check that out and hear it, because I feel like there are not many podcasts on the internet that you can go and listen to a definitive discussion about this game. And I'm glad that we did this, and we did it before everything shut down, right? And we're able to get that full experience, co-op online. It's a great time. So look forward to that next episode. But today we have other things to talk about. Bally, what's the show going to entail?
For the first segment, we're going to talk about the games that we have been playing. And for the second segment, we've got some emails. So we'll get to those.
Absolutely. So let's kick things off. Bally, last week, right after we recorded, a game came out, and it's a very short game, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to take an evening, I'm going to play this, I'm going to play the whole thing, and that's exactly what I did. I played a little game called Venba. Venba is a game that has been doing the rounds a little bit. Kind of funny, did a fun thing where they interviewed one of the developers, and he basically took them through like a press preview, and they basically allowed everybody in their audience to take a look at that to get an idea of like, hey, this is what happens when the press talk to developers and what they tell them about games and stuff like that. And it was interesting because for me in particular, this game is a game about an Indian family in Canada. If you don't know, and you can't tell from my voice because that's how podcasts work, I am of Indian descent, and it's a kind of immigrant story of these two characters who moved to Canada in, I think, like, it might be the 90s or the 80s, but they moved there for a better life. And
you know what part of Canada?
I can't remember. I'm not sure if they're actually specific about where it is. I'm not sure if they actually nail that down. But I know that the developers are Canadian, so they are like they are kind of Indian descent living in Canada as well. So I feel like there's definitely some sort of autobiographical stuff going on here. Makes sense. But the premise of the game is that it's a cooking game. So it's a narrative cooking game, and you experience the lives of these characters over a set period of time. There are time jumps and stuff. So you kind of start when they arrive, and then they find out, oh, hey, we're pregnant, so we should probably stay. And then they skip forward like 5 years, and it's like, oh, here's their son and stuff like that.
So the intention is to return to India, you mean?
Originally, yeah, they're right. Like, oh, we should probably, like, things are hard here, it's very difficult to get a job, there's language barriers, that sort of stuff. But then they realize, oh, we came here because we wanted a better life, and now we're gonna have a baby, so we should probably stay here and make the most of it. And so, yeah, it jumps around different periods of that that life as the years go on, and yeah, we'll all make big time jumps here and there, but the entire premise is built around food, and it's built around specifically Tamil food and South Indian food, right? So I am not of South Indian descent, but I have eaten a lot of South Indian food. There's lots of places around London that do that stuff, and it is it's very much like a family thing, especially like with my mum's grandparents, of us always going to a certain South Indian place nearby, and having stuff like dosa and idli and these uttapam, these types of foods that I love, and are kind of Indian in their nature, but are not specifically like where my family comes from. But there's definitely a deep connection to that. And I think that because I know this food very well and I have an understanding of it, it was very fun to see the process of making it. The way it works is, so you'll have some kind of narrative segments where you'll get dialogue and sometimes dialogue choices. The art style is very kind of minimalist, but very, very pretty. Like, I think it captures a kind of classic kind of like simple vibe, but has some heart to it as well. Like, I just like the look to it. It's very distinctive. And so you have those segments of narrative, but then they are linked together by these cooking segments. So I think the first one is idli, in fact. And so what you do is you have these different tools in the kitchen, and you have to put things together to make the recipe. The problem is that oftentimes the recipe book is either has like a bit cut out of it, or it's covered in some kind of grease, or it's basically so the main character is called Venba, and so her mother's recipe book is what she has, and so she's kind of like trying to keep that connection to her heritage by kind of cooking these dishes, but because it's an old recipe book, it's been beaten up, and there's, you know, not everything is there properly. Also, some of it is written in Tamil, and so it's you know, as someone who can't read that, it's hard to understand what to do as a player, right? So you are basically making inferences and using information kind of not in a detective-y way, but in a way where you're kind of putting things together and being like, how do I actually make this dish? What is the order in which I should do things? And there are sometimes images and descriptions and pictures that help you to do that. So in this first dish, you have to take the batter and put it into the three different slots. But you then have to make sure that when you line it up, there's air holes underneath. So you have to like spin it in a certain direction, and you have to make sure that before you put the batter, you make sure that there is a cloth covering it so that it doesn't overflow, essentially. So it actually took me a few times to do the first one, because I was like, how am I actually putting this together? I think it's quite clever in that way, because it's kind of minimalist puzzle solving. It's not asking a lot of you, and there is only kind of one solution, and eventually you'll get it, but I think it's a nice approach as opposed to making it, because I think a lot of these narrative games don't use games as a medium very well, in the sense that they're like, well, you're just going to do this thing kind of linearly, and you won't have a lot of kind of thought going into it. And I think this game does that quite well, especially kind of ramps up as you get to more complicated recipes and stuff.
Right,
like that.
I was going
to
ask, like, is this just kind of visual novelty with some cooking in there, or is it doing something unique, and, you know, it is telling its story through the video game medium, and, you know, it pulls off the meaning of what it's trying to do through the medium in a unique way, like a Brothers, or is it not quite hitting those echelons?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it hits that. I think what it does do, though, is it engages you in the act of creation, and I think that connects you more to the character. There is a certain sequence in the middle of the game, which is, I should say, this game is it's sad. It's a sad video game. It's heartbreaking in a lot of ways, and I think, like, in the end, like, it comes out with something very touching and beautiful, but it, like, to the journey to get there, you know, it's not an easy journey, right? And I think there's a section in the middle of the game where you're like, there's this incredible cooking sequence and the music and the way it all comes together, and then you get to the end of that sequence and you are just punched. You're just punched in the gut. And I think it's super effective at doing that, but also it's just really effective at getting the that feeling of cooking across, mainly through the sound design. The sound design in this game is absolutely astonishing. It is like the best, like the sound of frying onions has never sounded better than it does in this game. And I know that from kind of watching that kind of funny thing, they had somebody cook these recipes and like deliberately record the sounds that the food made while it was being cooked, which I think is super cool. And it really shows because, yeah, when you add things to the pan and you start hearing it sizzle, like that sound of the sizzle is really resonant. And I think it just captures that moment super well. And the music as well that they choose to go along with it, I think it just comes together in this really beautiful package that I think is, it's only an hour and a half long and tells a story so succinctly and so clearly, while also tapping into, for me, like every time I came across a dish, I'm like, oh my god, they're doing uttapam, like that's my favorite thing I have when I go to that restaurant, and I'm the one who has it. And like mainly my sister, my parents always have like dosa, which I like, but it's not my thing. So you're making dosa and then they're like, oh, you're gonna make uttapam as well. I'm like, oh shit, this is my thing, that's what I want to do. So I thought that was really cool, and like I think just having that familiarity with the food made it hit stronger for me, but also just like culturally as well. And I think, you know, my grandmother passed away earlier this year, and she was the one who would always go with us to that restaurant as well, and she was, you know, she introduced it to us and everything. And so yeah, there's that kind of connection as well that makes it resonate more strongly for me. But I think it is, it's really well made and crafted, and just overall is just I highly recommend it. It's on Switch, it's on Game Pass, and I think it's one of my favorite things I've played this year. I think it's really fantastic. So it's called Venba. Do check it out. And if you have, if you're hungry before playing it, I recommend eating first and then playing it, because otherwise you will be extremely hungry from those cooking sounds for sure.
So, has it made you want to cook some of these dishes?
Yeah, in some ways. It's really funny because we recently had a family birthday for my cousin and my uncle, and they hired in the garden someone who makes dosa, and so they basically have this hot plate. So I've seen it made in front of me, so I know the process of it, where you have this hot plate and the batter basically goes onto it, and they use this kind of circular thing to spread it out. It's incredibly thin. It's basically made of like rice and stuff like that, and it spreads out onto this hot plate and sizzles on it, and it is like, it's basically a paper thin kind of it's not pancakey, but it's like, think of the thinnest pancake you've ever seen. That's kind of what it is, but it's savory. And so I have seen this stuff being cooked before. And the thing is, like, a lot of it requires a bit more specialist equipment. It's maybe a little bit harder. But like, my grandmother's made idli before. I've had that at home and stuff like that. So there's definitely a component of like, yeah, it would be cool to cook this stuff. But I don't know, I feel like I've been around it so often. I'm so used to having it at places that I feel I've heard a lot of people on podcasts be like, I've never heard of this food before and I want to cook it. It's a little bit different for me because I'm very familiar with it, and so it doesn't hit me in that same way. But yeah, I mean, going through the process of doing it in this game was very cool, I thought, at least. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Real surprise of the year, just to kind of come along and tell a story like that.
I've been following it for a little while. I actually did reach out to these guys before, when, you know, trying to see if we could publish it or something. Nice. I never got a response back, but it's cool, and I'm very glad that the game got put out there and people are enjoying it. And I think it's a super,
got some
super
good reviews. Project.
Well. Yeah, it has. Yeah. And I definitely strongly echo those and recommend it. But yeah, make sure you haven't eaten, make sure you're full, and also make sure that you have some tissues ready, because it'll definitely gut punch you. Bali, from one game about carrying food to another, I guess.
They both have food in them. We'll go with that.
Yeah, sure.
I've been playing more Pikmin 4.
You have, yeah.
I've been pretty busy, so I'm only kind of maybe 11-ish, 12-ish hours in, and I'm in the third area, and it's really, like, this game is really growing on me. Like, I already liked it a lot, but I just keeps doing its thing, and I'm really enjoying it. I've done the thing that you talked about vaguely last episode of MBZ, where there is a difficult enemy that you cannot defeat, and then you kind of, stuff happens, and
you find a means to get rid of it, but yeah,
right. And yeah, that was hard, and I lost a lot of Pikmin, and I'm glad I'm past that bit, but it was fun. I liked the way it mixed up the gameplay. I didn't think it was too horrendous. It was very, very strange. It was a bit surreal, but yes, you know, definitely. I'm glad the game mixed up in that way. I think that there was also that thing that I don't want to spoil, but you were like, oh, Bally, there's something that links to, like, a game you really like that's really cool. Yes. And I picked that thing up and I was like, wow, that is... Yeah, and I was just talking off mic before this episode with you saying, like, I think this is why they went with that. But anyway, I don't know. I think it was really cool they included that. I do want to spoil one thing, and that's the best looking food I've seen so far.
Okay,
so
great.
If you don't
want to
know what any food is that you pick up in this game, maybe skip 20 seconds. But I think the nigiri in the water area looks impeccable. It looks so shiny and just want to eat it. Like the red tuna nigiri just looks so damn good. And like, I actually picked it up in one of the dungeons in the third area, and I know you were saying like some of the dungeons aesthetically were a little bit dull, but I actually thought that some of these dungeons, it's almost like you're in like a fish tank, and
yeah, it's like an aquarium kind of
right.
deal.
And I think it looked really nice, actually. Like, I was really impressed, like, just how pretty the game continues to be, and like some of those vistas that you're just kind of seeing there. You couldn't really have done that in, let's say, a Pikmin 2 when they previously used dungeons a lot, for example.
Yes,
like, I think they're really using the power of the Switch, which is not really something you hear in games media at the moment often. But I think it's just a really pretty game, and I'm really enjoying continuing collecting things. I think that the night missions, they're fine. I'll definitely admit I would have way rather have preferred if they had been as bold as the Wild at Heart and tried to do some sort of way of being able to essentially keep your character out overnight and integrate the map into it. Even if you like stayed awake and then it went to nighttime and then you did the tower defense, it might even feel a little more thematically pleasing, perhaps. I don't know, it just feels, it's very stark the way that you come back. I think it also uses up an entire day.
It does, yeah, so it adds to your total,
right?
Which,
so
if you care about that, because it doesn't really matter in this game, but I guess if you're going for like, hey, I want to do it in under a certain number, then it adds to that total, basically.
I think I'm on day 21 or 2 already.
Okay.
Or something. So do you know what day you finish, or you saw credits on?
I think I saw credits around 35 or something
35,
like that.
Okay.
I'm currently on day 47. So yeah, the post game continues with lots more stuff. But yeah, I feel like I'm going to end at day 60 or something. I imagine.
No, that's fair. But yeah, I just, those night missions are fine. But I think there's so much more they could have done with Pikmin and night and using glow Pikmin, and that could have been something so much better, which is a shame.
You used the glow Pikmin at all outside of those areas? Because you do get those seeds and
they become
part of your pack, so
to my knowledge they just light up the area, right?
No, I think you can just add them to your army. They basically just become extra Pikmin that get added crew. So like, if, for example, if you're down in a cave in the main section of the game, you can be like, oh, I've lost some, so I need to replenish
that's a nice
them.
Idea. No, I've not used them yet, but that's good to know for when the caves get trickier and longer and I need some backup Pikmin for sure. I'm still really enjoying like the Dandori battles. I still don't like that they're split screen. That just seems like a very Nintendo decision that is
very baffling.
Unforgivable. But then the kind of like timed challenge ones where it's just about being efficient and going after platinum, I kind of enjoy that more because it's full screen and you're not kind of fighting anyone technically, you're just fighting the clock, and I think I enjoy those slightly more. But yeah, I'm really enjoying like the balance of those challenges, the night stuff, the overworld, the dungeons. It's just a really chilled balance of play styles and things that like they want to include in this game, and I'm really impressed. Like, yes, there are aspects of Pikmin 3 I'm missing, like those big bombastic bosses. I'm missing a handful of the puzzles where you got the three different characters interacting in a really unique way.
Right.
But I think they've set up enough new stuff where a potential Pikmin 5 on the Switch successor could take the best bits from Pikmin 3 and 4 and create something even better than this game. And I think that's a really nice idea that might come to fruition one day. I don't know, but like, this game is doing lots of really great new stuff. It's a shame there's a couple of things from Pikmin 3 that I would have liked in here, but like, I'm still very impressed and really want to play more. And I know you've seen a hell of a lot more than me now.
Yeah, so I've not got to second credits yet. I am currently at, there's kind of the final area that I'm basically at the point of now. And what I will say is, some of the stuff you're talking about, you get a bit more of it post credits.
Okay.
So so you may be a bit more
big ass
happy.
Bosses, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. So like you maybe get a little bit more of that. I still not in the same way as Pikmin 3, but like it's improved. I'll say. And I think the difficulty definitely ramps up in terms of you really do have to be careful. There was one boss in particular where I was like, oh, wow, I need to use the environment in a smart way, and I need to be thinking strategically about where I'm moving and how I'm moving,
right.
Because otherwise I will just lose all my Pikmin in one fell swoop here, and that will be really bad.
I do like that. I like the challenge.
Yes, but I do also appreciate that the rewind exists, because it, as much right. as I didn't use it that much in the main part of the game, in the post game, I feel like I've used it like way more than you know, I was intending to anyway. I was like, oh, wow, I got into this area. The real rough part is when you have types of Pikmin that are super rare, and so you don't want to lose them. Like, purple Pikmin are incredibly powerful, and they are very hard to find. So if you lose even like six or something, you're like, oh fuck, I can't stand yeah. losing six of those, you know.
I agree. If they're not, unless they're red, blue, or yellow Pikmin, I'm very defensive of those other types of Pikmin, and I'm sounding like a massive racist over here, but like the red, blue, and yellow Pikmin, it's like, ah, they're disposable, you can get some more, but like those other
all
ones
goes back to the color people, Mally. but yes, I think that having it's interesting, because some of the caves that you do in the post game, they provide you with more of those types of Pikmin.
Yes.
So like you can find those flowers, right, which let you basically transform one type into another. And so I'll be down there with a bunch of like rock Pikmin, and I have some white and some purple, and I see a flower that's purple. I'm like, well, I'm getting rid of a bunch of rock Pikmin in order to get these purple ones. So it's a trade-off basically as you go down. And to some extent, it might mean like, okay, I'm trading off because I want more purples, but in this case, like the rock ones might actually be more helpful for this certain situation. So it's it's an interesting thing where I'm losing some of those, even though I came in with a lot more. But then ultimately, my benefit is, and I want to basically leave the cave net positive. So I want to leave the cave with more purple and more white Pikmin than I came in with. I find myself being more careful, because at usually the end of these caves, there is a challenge, and you don't want to lose all the Pikmin you've just kind of you've created in that last bout. And so I find myself being even more careful in those situations because of that. Because you want to get back to the surface and be like, okay, now I have 30 purple Pikmin, so I can feel a bit more cavalier about using them, you know?
I've been impressed by how many of the enemies have a hidden attack and have something that's just like, oh, damn, like I just thought you were like a plain little fish, but then you just spiked out the whole front of your face and killed six Pikmin in one go. I'm pleased that some of the enemies are just pack a punch, really, and they're not just quite as docile as maybe you think they are based on the first area. Like, there's a lot more.
The crabs are real assholes. Oof, in that third area. They're super difficult to deal with, and to the point where for the big crabs, I was actually using the bombs. I was like, I'm just going to use these bombs to blow up their shell or their claw.
Bally tactics. I like it.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, like, I don't remember using items. I think there were items in Pikmin 3 to some degree, but I don't remember really using them. I use items more frequently here. Like, it's not that often. It's mainly the bombs, if I'm honest, but I do have a good amount of items, and I think it's one of those things I should think about going to more, because they are super useful, and they will save you some Pikmin lives if you do use them smartly. So
is your Orochi completely powered up?
He's almost fully powered up. Okay. I think I've only got two more things to max out,
but it's like, he crucial in some of those fights, or you still find the Pikmin way more powerful, kind of thing?
It depends on the fight. I think for a lot of these fights, I'm still riding on Orochi, and so there are certain enemies later on where the only way to damage them is to charge at them with Orochi, which then flips them over so you can attack their soft bit, basically. Like, none of the Pikmin will do damage until Orochi charges to actually create an opening to where they can go in on. That happens quite frequently later on in the game. Orochi can be super powerful in terms of his movement stuff, where there's a giant watermelon in the third area, and by that point, my Orochi was able to carry 100 Pikmin. who was able to train the 100 pikmin. Yeah. So I was like, you go over there and just take the watermelon on your own, because I don't have any other means of getting out of there. So yeah, that's really helpful. I've had a few people be like, oh, it's a bit of a shame that the max limit is 100. Like, even after the credit, there's no, like, even bigger onion that you get past 100. That's the maximum you have, which is a little surprising, I guess, because the first game had 100, right? And I think you started with that, or you had the ability to have 100 from the beginning.
I mean, the game does run seamlessly well. And, like, yes, there are loading. There's quite a lot of loading screens, and that's maybe one downside. But, like, you know, it's a very, very good-looking Nintendo Switch game. Like, it's incredibly, incredibly good-looking. And to render, like, 100 Pikmin, often in three different types, all doing different things, and to render Ochi and your player, and they're all doing things, and they're coming together, lifting pieces, doing whatever.
And that AI is, like, pretty on point.
Yeah, like it's surprising how well this game runs. So, like, if they don't want to stretch that by going over 100 Pikmin, I'll let them off this time. But maybe that's another thing that could be introduced to a potential Pikmin 5 on Switch 2. Like, that would that could be cool.
I think that's a big jump, though, right? When you think about going back to the original Pikmin games, the AI stuff is probably the hardest thing to go back to, I would imagine, because they were just starting to use the technology for the first time, and having 100 little creatures on screen all at once, like, you're never going to nail it properly. Yeah. And it feels like you can have Pikmin going off in other side of the map. They'll still be registered as being there, and you can call them all back to the base or to you. And yeah, I think that there's rarely a point where it's my fault that something, I think it's the game's fault that something's gone wrong with a Pikmin, in terms of it getting hung up on a piece of geometry or stuff. It's usually my fault for leaving someone behind.
They should go up to 128, though. That is the fabled GameCube number for Mario 128.
It is. It's funny, actually. I don't know if you looked at any of the, there were some interviews that came out around Pikmin 4's launch. Nintendo had been starting to do not Iwata asks, but like a similar style of thing with their developers. And a few things came out of that, one of them being that, like, Miyamoto wasn't really the guy to invent Pikmin, actually. It was actually these other two people who had been trying to do it for a while, and they're part of that interview. They're still on the team and making Pikmin. And another one was the myth that Mario 128 turned into, was the idea for Pikmin, and it wasn't. That was never... Pikmin was actually in development before Mario 128 existed as an idea. So, it's interesting illuminating some of those myths that we've all run with for so many years. So it's cool that Nintendo are doing those... getting that information out there, rare and reticent as they are to do it, they actually have. So worth seeking those out if you haven't read them. But yeah, I think I'm kind of slow playing the rest of this game at the moment, partially because I'm like, I kind of want to make it last a little bit longer. You know, I think having those the feeling of having a brand new area is really nice in this game, where you're like, okay, I'm gonna hit the ground running, and it's almost a... It works against you, this feeling of I'm going to do all this stuff in the overworld, and then you get back and your progress doesn't feel like meaningful. The first full day I spent in the first post-game area, I did a bunch of stuff, and then I came back and it was like 1%. I'm like, that's a joke game. I did so many things. Yeah. I opened routes. But I think, like, the game doesn't tell you, it doesn't reward you for opening shortcuts or, like, getting to a place. And
I think that percentage is purely treasure-based, and then 90% of the treasure is below ground. And yeah, it's brutal.
I think actually the highest percentage is rescues. So, like, if you leave a bunch of the Dandori fights, then, like... like, one rescue is like 15 or 20%, and it's like, wow, that's... it just feels like a little bit weird in that stuff. But, you know, I think that's kind of a minor complaint, I would say, in the grand scheme of things. That what I'm chasing at is that feeling of starting a new area and just discovering a bunch of new stuff and being like, ooh, I can do this and that, and I can go and collect this, and which way do I want to go first? You know, there's nice autonomy to it. You can choose your path through it, and, you know, as linear as it is, at least those areas are kind of open for you to tackle however you want to. Yeah, I think there's just some really nice stuff still in the late game, and it's adding a bit more challenge. If you are someone who missed the time pressure from Pikmin 3 or Pikmin 1, there is something in this game for you. I think it's a very cool thing, and the way they handle it is really neat.
I look forward to it.
To me, it's like, oh God, this is another extra thing for this game. Like, after doing all this other stuff and finishing the post credits, like, yes, there's still another chunk of this game that you can go and do, which is very cool. So I don't know how much I'll do of that stuff, because I don't know, I feel like I've got my fill once I will have 100%ed everything, but there's more to Pikmin 4. It's almost a never-ending gobstopper of a Pikmin game. This is by far the longest one in the series by quite a margin.
So, oh, yeah, by a ton. You don't have to answer this question if it's spoilers, but does this extra thing you're alluding to, does it affect like your percentage of things collected for the main game?
It does not, no. It's a totally separate thing. And it's, yeah, it's
are you all like keen to do it?
Yeah, I think originally when I first like started it, I was like, oh, is this going to be a retread of some stuff? But I was like, wait, no, this is all like new as well. I was kind of flabbergasted. I'm like, oh, okay, this feels like pretty significant. So my main goal is to just get to the second credits and kind of do all the 100% stuff. But I can see myself going back and chipping away at this other thing.
We'll see how that goes.
It's a great game. It's really good. It's high up on my game of the year list for sure. I think it's great, and I'm really glad it's selling well. You know, I'm glad that it's kind of getting a bit more crack through to a broader audience. And
what are your predictions for sales of it by the end of the year?
Ooh, it's a good question. I mean, it would be great if it kind of matches a Fire Emblem level, so like 3 million, you know? I think three houses is about 3 million. Yeah. I think it can do that, and I think if it does, I think that's really good news for the future of Pikmin, because it will have done a lot better than any previous game. So there you go. Pikmin 4, go get it. It's real good. Bally, the last thing that I want to talk about is a game.
You've been playing this game a long time.
I have, yeah. I started it on my plane to GDC back in March on the Steam Deck, and that is Rogue Legacy 2, a game that is also available on Switch and I think is like a perfect handheld game, if I'm honest. You know, if you're going to play this anywhere, either do it on a Steam Deck or on a Switch. I really love the first Rogue Legacy. It was the first roguelike that I'd ever played, and I think it was, for many people, kind of a breakthrough into that genre space, partially because it has progression, right? And it's the kind of roguelite name stems from stuff like Rogue Legacy, right? Where it's has the repeated castle that you go through and you're fighting enemies and you have bosses to fight, but at the end of the day you come back with all the gold that you collected and you dump that gold into this kind of hub area that increases your damage, increases your health, increases all these other aspects, weapons, everything, and you slowly build up your power, both in terms of your knowledge of the game and how good you are at it, but also you're getting that slight buff as well. And you know, I tended to gravitate more towards this type of roguelike where you have that stuff, permanent upgrades and stuff like that, which I think is really cool. It's funny because I went back and looked at footage of the original Rogue Legacy comparing it to 2, and it's such a massive difference. It's kind of unbelievable because I went into 2 being like, oh yeah, this is always what Rogue Legacy looked like. No, sir. Rogue Legacy 1 was a pixel art game. And I went back and I was like, oh shit, yeah, this is really chunky. And it actually looks very old now by modern standards. Rogue Legacy 2 is a gorgeous video game. Oh my goodness, it looks so fantastic. And it's one of those things where the art is so amazing that it tricks you into thinking it's fully 2D, whereas every single character is a 3D model. They have painted it in such a way that it looks like a crisp 2D hand-drawn style. And I only noticed this when I was playing it on PC, because when I was playing on Steam Deck, because of the smaller screen and everything, it just looks hand-painted the whole way through. And as soon as I got to my PC, I was like, oh, now I can see that there are actual like 3D kind of characters and everything here. But it's so well done, it's so crisp and sharp that you'd be forgiven for thinking that was the case. I think this game is fantastic. I think it is better than the first game in a lot of ways. And I think it actually has a really unique setup as a roguelite. The first Rogue Legacy, you were in this castle, and every time that you started, you start in one of the biomes and you'd go through it and you would eventually fight the boss of that biome, right? And when you'd done that, you would then have to go to another biome and fight the boss of that biome. And the tricky part of it was that you'd always start in the first part of the castle. So every time you do a run, you'd start there. And so even if you'd beaten the first boss, you'd be like, okay, I'm going to start in the first part of the castle, but I have to get to this area that's usually on the west side of the map. So I have to go through all the opening starting area, fight all the enemies, get there. By the time I get there, you know, maybe I've worn down a little bit, my health is a bit lower, I don't have as many resources, and so I get into that harder area and then I die quite quickly and I'm like, okay, I have to start all the way from the beginning. And so I think I played about 20 to 25 hours of the original Rogue Legacy. I never finished the first Rogue Legacy. I beat the first boss of 4 or 5, I think, and actually never got much further than that. I really loved it, and at the time, you know, I was like, well, it's a roguelike, right? Nobody beats these types of games, so I wasn't really on my agenda to do so anyway.
I was in the pre-Hades era.
I guess so,
roguelikes.
Before I beat roguelike 50 times nonstop. But I think the nice thing about this game is it has a similar setup where there are, you know, you start the game and there's a big door and the door is covered by like 7 paintings. And the idea is beat the 7 bosses to open the big door to the final big boss, essentially. And that's what the first game was as well. It's like beat the 4 bosses to open the big door at the very beginning. But the nice thing about this is once you have cleared an area, once you have beaten the boss, you get to the next area and there's a teleporter there and you basically pay 1500 gold to the pizza lady who stands there. She's a girl who has a pizza slice on her hat. I never understood why. Okay. But I didn't read any of the stuff. There's a bunch of lore in this game. Like, you come across books and stuff. I just A-button my way through everything. I have no idea what the story of this game is. Do not give a shit. Don't care. And I don't know. I feel like these games feel like they need to have that stuff.
Maybe you'd explain why this is a pizza lady.
Yeah, maybe they did. Maybe some deep lore reason, but to be honest, the writing was just, I don't know, it wasn't hitting with me, so I was like, I'm just going to skip all of this. But you pay her gold, and then unlocks a teleporter, which means that every time you get into the castle, there's a teleporter as soon as you get there, and you can just teleport straight to that second area. So it's really interesting where I had finished the first area, and then I basically never went back to it. I basically went into the next one, and then I focused my effort on getting through this one. So every new area has new enemies, new patterns, learning a different space, understanding what it is you need to do. And each one has kind of a little puzzle in order to unlock the boss. So, you know, one of them was to find a couple of keys, and the keys were in certain rooms, and you had to collect them and then use that key to unlock a portal, beat a mini boss in the portal, and then that would unlock one of the sections to get the boss open, right? So every area has a little thing like this where there was a bit of a trick, a bit of a puzzle to getting to the boss. And right, over time, as you go through this biome, you find all the different rooms, you fight all the different enemies, you're collecting gold still. So it's the same setup where you die, you go back to the home base, and you put all your money into your castle, building it up, getting different stats, increasing things like your weapon crit rate and your health and your armor and your weight. There are a lot of systems in this game, so it's very different in terms of, you now have a bunch of different classes. So the first Rogue Legacy, you are just this knight guy and you have this overhead sword, and you just swing this sword and you can swing it downwards, you can swing it left, right, up, and it's quite versatile and it's a good weapon, but there's no other type of weapon. That's the only weapon you have in the game, and that's how you play the game, and that's it. So you start with that guy in this game, but then over time, as you get more money and you unlock more parts of the castle, new classes will appear. So this is stuff like a gunslinger. So it's someone who just has a gun and they can hover in midair shooting that gun, and then they run out of bullets and you actually have to reload the gun and then go again. You have bow and arrow, which is another ranged class. You have samurais, I think, who basically have like a katana blade who has a much longer reach horizontally, but they can also attack diagonally up and down as well. You have chefs, who are my favorite class in the game and the one that I put the most time into, where they have a pan, and when you hit an enemy with the pan, the enemy gets set on fire, and so damage over time happens to that enemy. So you hit an enemy once, and then you can move away from it, and the enemy will just boop, 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 damage over time, and die. And the chef was amazing because one of its sub-abilities was to heal yourself. So I could heal myself, as well as have this thing where I just hit enemies once and then move on. It feels to me like a broken class. Like, it was the best class in the game for me by far, and I used it constantly. You have a lancer who can attack in all four directions. One of the changes to this game is that in the first game, there was this idea with the sword where you would hit downwards and you'd be able to bounce off of enemies' heads, or you could hit downwards on a platform to make it appear and land on it. And that has been changed to where instead of doing the attack button down, you do the jump button down, which when I first played it on the plane, I was complaining to my colleague about this as we were flying over to San Francisco. I was like, why did they do this in this game? This is a baffling decision. But what I did was I changed the key binding. So I just rewired. Luckily, I did it right at the beginning of the game, so my brain wasn't messed up by controls. But I rebound all the controls and I changed it so that it was on the Y button instead. So I had basically a spin dash move, which let you bounce on enemies' heads. And I separated it in my mind as a different type of move, so it wouldn't be connected to the weapon, essentially. So it's basically like a spin kind of bounce. I'd compare it to like in Mario 2 or in Mario World where he does the spin jump. It's kind of like a spin jump, I guess, where you can bounce off the top of enemies' heads, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
And some enemies require you to do that to kill them. But that's an element to this as well. There are so many classes. There must be at least 15 classes in this game, all with different weapons, all play totally different, and so it really adds a level of replayability and just diversity to your build, so that you can, every time you go in, you're like, okay, I'm going to take the guy with the axe this time, and the axe is different because it's much slower, but it does massive damage on the ground. But if you jump, you start spinning, and you start spinning with the axe in your hand, and it does like a kind of razor blade attack, essentially. So like every weapon feels so varied and different. And obviously I had my favorites that I gravitated towards, and in the end, you know, I focused on particular ones. But I really think it's just such a big expansion in that way, as well as having different biomes with different layouts. Like the second biome is a more horizontal one where you're going all the way horizontally across the screen instead of, you know, the traditional castle, which is like rooms all around the place and it's dotted about. Feels almost like a Dead Cells level, actually, because Dead Cells are set up in that way where you have, you remember like the second biome in Dead Cells where it's almost like an all like long stretch across the ground. So it kind of feels like that, which was super interesting. And then there's an area which is a lot more vertical, where you're going up these shafts and you're trying to get to the top of a tower, basically.
Yeah. That's like Dead Cells as well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think like they really varied it up in terms of the types of biomes, the enemies that you find. And because it is so segmented, it really felt like progress. When I finished a biome, I beat the boss of the biome, I'm like, awesome. Now I get to go to a brand new area with a brand new look, music, enemies. And it felt like having a fresh game every time, which was super cool. And I think that was something that just kept me ticking through the game. And I was basically playing it during the evening in my bed, like on Steam Deck. Great handheld game. One thing I will say is that I wasn't as good on Steam Deck as I was on a regular controller, because I decided one night, I was like, oh, I'm just going to play on PC and see how it looks. First of all, runs so smoothly on my 144Hz monitor. Holy shit. You think that like the difference between 60 and 120 isn't big, and then you play it back to back and you're like, oh no, there is a big difference here. Even in a 2D game, it's incredibly smooth. And I think that actually did help me, because I was struggling against the boss of the fifth biome, and I literally beat it the first time I tried on the PC, because I died to it like 6 or 7 times on Steam Deck.
You needed those extra frames just to predict what was which move the boss was going to make.
Yeah, but also like the Series X controller is really nice, and like I think it just, to me, feels better than a Steam Deck in terms of control.
Surely you could like link one of those up to your Steam Deck.
I could, yeah, but I'm not going to do that in bed, am I? I'm not going to, yeah.
You said that you could teleport through biomes, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Every time?
Yeah, so basically, once you've unlocked the teleporter for that biome, that teleporter is at the beginning of every biome, basically.
That's
that
doesn't sound very roguish, though.
Yeah, that's the thing, and that's why I think it is a little bit more unique in that way, because the problem would be, because these areas are quite long and the runs would still be 20 minutes.
Like much longer than like a Dead Cells area.
Yeah, that's the thing, like one of these biomes to get through it, to get to the boss, probably between 20 and 30 minutes, right? And you don't want to be in a situation at the end of the game where there are 7 biomes, and to get to the very final boss of the last one you have to play through 6 biomes. That's like a 5-hour run, which is just not feasible.
That's an interesting point, actually. What's a good example of a roguelike with a long run time? I was gonna say
probably Returnal.
Yeah, I was just going to say Returnal.
Highest profile example.
Is that like 3-4 hours, I want to say?
Yeah, it's super long, right? Yeah, yeah. And I think people complained about that, because one of the benefits of a roguelike is you know you're only committing an hour maximum to this run, right?
Yeah, I think Dead Cells and Hades are quite similar, and they're maybe 40-ish minutes.
I think Hades is like 20 minutes to half an hour usually, at least for me when I got to
when
the
you're
end
turtling, all right, it takes a bit longer.
Yeah, totally.
Those boss fights.
Yeah, exactly. But that's why I think this game is actually quite unique amongst roguelikes, because of that broken up structure, where it really did feel like I played 6 mini roguelikes, whereas like one biome feels like I'm going to conquer this area, I'm going to learn everything about its enemy patterns and how do I unlock the boss, and then I fight the boss a bunch of times, die a bunch, and then eventually conquer it. And then I'm like, okay, great, on to the next one. What's this fresh new area for me to see? I really like that about it. I think it limits its replayability for someone like me, because now I'm done. I'm like, well, I don't really want to go back, and I've done everything now. I've beaten all the bosses. So to me, it's like there's less importance. And so many of the upgrades are built around making your character stronger, as opposed to adding like wrinkles to the game that make it more difficult. There's a thing after you finish the game that lets you do that to increase like enemy health and damage and stuff like that, kind of like Hades does. But I basically felt like, okay, I finished it and I'm done, and I probably won't go back to play more of it. But I like that, actually. I think that it is one of those rare roguelikes that feels complete when you're done with it, and you can move on and you can feel satisfied that you've had a full experience. And I think it's just excellent in so many ways. The feel of it is perfect. Like, it's just super sublime to control. I did at the very... So, at the very end, I beat it quite quickly at the end because I decided I'm just going to finish it on PC instead of on Steam Deck, because I could see myself on Steam Deck just struggling too much against some of those harder enemies at the end. The final boss is one of my favorites I fought in a long time. Like, it has great patterns, and the way that it switches them up and the way you have to learn them. Like, I fought it, I think, 8 or 10 times, and then I beat it, which for me is like a perfect number. And actually, for the final boss, they give you a shortcut to just go straight to it. So, you don't even have to go through a biome. You can just be like, I'm gonna just go straight to the boss and fight it. And it was a really nice balance of difficulty, super challenging, but in a way that I was like, okay, I know what its moves are now. I just need to be on the ball in terms of dodging out the way and just having the precision to do it. And and I came out the other side being fantastic. I think it's just like a tremendous game, and definitely one of the better roguelikes that I have played. Nice. Strongly recommend it. And I think at this point, just play this one as opposed to the first one. I think it just makes sense.
All about the lore continuation.
I mean, you'll just miss out on why she has a pizza on her hat. But I'm sure that, you know, you can work your way around it. The one thing that doesn't quite work for me in this game is, like, there are systems in there that feel a little extraneous. You know how in Slay the Spire you find, like, artifacts, right? Which increase stuff on your run, you get bonuses, and sometimes they'll just really help you break the game, basically.
Yeah.
You find those here. They're called relics. They have this system which is a little confusing, where you have this percentage gauge, and if you get a relic, it takes the number off that percentage, and the percentage is over 100. So say your percentage is 186, you could pick up a relic that is like a percentage of 30, so it'll take that 186 down to 156. Basically, if you take too many relics, your percentage goes down to under 100%, and when you go under 100%, your health and mana get reduced. It's a weird system. It's a little convoluted and complicated, and I didn't really like it. There's also this weight system where your gear is based on weight, and some of it will, like, you can upgrade it, but the amount of stats that you gain or lose, like, you get defense points or health increase, and I never knew which one I should focus on, or like, why do I have this extra weight to carry stuff? Like, it was a little bit cumbersome in terms of its system mechanics, and I just don't think it does a good job of explaining any of them, really. So for the most part, I was just like, I guess I'll just do the one that gives me the highest stats, and I wasn't even sure at that point. But I will say that's the one thing that kind of I detract from, is like, I think it could have been streamlined a lot more and made a bit more simple, especially because you have so much variety with like the weapons and the characters already, that you don't need extra systems like that added on top. But yeah, I think overall a tremendous roguelike, very highly recommended. Play Rogue Legacy 2, it's really, really good. So there you go. That is going to close us out for this first part of the show. Don't go anywhere though, because we'll be back after the break with your emails. See you in a bit.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to the second part of today's show. It's time for emails. We are kind of running low. It's getting lower than it was, which isn't great. So we do need more emails. You can send them to thisnintendolife@gmail.com. That is thisnintendolife@gmail.com. We also have a channel on our Discord server. It is called Emails. And we have two emails written into our Discord server that we'd like to cover today. So our first email is from Dave97 from Discord. Says, a recent report suggests that the Switch successor dev kits are in the wild. It seems a new generation of Nintendo hardware is approaching late 2024. Which old Nintendo IPs do you think will still make it onto the current Switch before it truly becomes obsolete? I'm personally hoping for something Rhythm Heaven related.
All right. I mean, we've talked so much about what the potential is for a successor and when it will happen and how it will happen and why it will happen. And it feels like a lot of things have converged at this point. There were some bits and pieces out of the Activision Blizzard lawsuit going on with Microsoft and potentially the acquisition there. So little bits and pieces there. I think Nintendo also said to their shareholders directly, we won't have a new thing this fiscal year, right? Which rules out anything before March of 2024. So if you align everything and obviously trust VGC, who are very trustworthy, have good sources and are pretty much on point when it comes to a lot of this reporting.
This is a multiple sourced story as well, yes. Which is always important.
Absolutely. It seems like it's very likely that come the end of next year, we will have a brand new Nintendo system in our hands. And I think the reporting was like, yes, it's also going to be a hybrid kind of handheld console thing.
Takes cartridges, has an LCD screen.
Yes. Yeah. Which is an interesting point, right? Because we were just discussing that of like, they're going back to LCD as opposed to OLED. And part of that is a cost thing because OLED screens are more expensive. You know, if you try and buy an OLED TV versus a non-OLED TV, you're always going to be paying more for that premium just because it's prettier, it's more expensive. And Nintendo, as we know, like to keep costs down as much as they can. And then over the generation, they'll be like, well, now that costs have fallen, we can invest in different technology and, you know, make these new versions of our hardware, which are a little bit more expensive potentially, but kind of let people, adopt a new version. And I don't know, that bums me out a little bit in the sense that now that I've seen the true light with the OLED, I'm like, I'd never want to go back from it.
You have to go back. They're making you go back.
Yeah, I think that's one of the benefits, Bally, if you're just staying with your original Switch, is you'll never know that you could have had it better, basically.
Ignorance is bliss. I'm still happy with my 60 frames per second. I don't need any of this 120 FPS you're on. And it's great.
Yeah, totally. And I think the other thing was, I think they said it's like an 8-inch screen. Maybe I'm conflating a little bit. There was another kind of bit of information that came out of another known leaker. And I think Ali Robertson from VGC kind of corroborated some of what that person was saying as well. So I think that means it would be 1 inch larger than even the OLED screen size.
That is which a lot.
It's pretty significant.
It's handheld, yeah.
Yeah, sure. And it sounds like that it would be quite a bit bigger than in that case, which would be a nice upgrade. And I don't know, like, I mean, how do you feel about the size of the Switch generally? Like, do you think that anything bigger is makes it worse for travel and stuff like that?
I can go bigger. I don't love the idea of going smaller, and it can be a much more efficient use of, like,
the space, basically.
The space. You don't need the bezel. So the only time I use the word bezel is talking about like a DS or a Switch or like a game system is like the bit of plastic that you don't really need. So you want the screen to kind of go to the edge, like kind of like looking at my like MacBook right now, the screen kind of goes to the edge.
Or like modern TVs, right? Where they are pretty much like very thin and the screen size is equivalent to, you know, the edge is very kind of minor.
I know we're going to talk a lot about the successor. I was going to touch on Dave's question very quickly in the sense that, like, I kind of wouldn't want Rhythm Heaven to come to the existing Switch. I would just want it to come to the new one. And I think I'd probably have that view of most games that are, like, haven't quite made it to Switch yet. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a benefit to a less popular thing in a series coming out late in a console's lifespan because the install base is so astronomically high that there's a bigger chance of a wider audience picking up that game. So like Pikmin is kind of benefiting from that right now because there's not a huge amount of stuff coming out for Switch this year, and so Nintendo's big games are Pikmin.
It's been a huge year for Switch.
I guess like in the you're right. I'm just making stuff up. But you know, like I guess like right in this moment, you know, Pikmin is the one thing of the month, and so it's
still
like
a good space for it to come out.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that benefits a game like Rhythm Heaven, where Well, you can kind of do it both ways, right? Because there's a potential that if it launches with a new system, then you're like, well, people have nothing else to buy, so they have to buy something.
Yeah,
and so,
that window doesn't last very long, though. But no. That's definitely a window.
You basically have to be like right up at launch in order to be in that window. Yeah. And if you're not, then yeah, it doesn't quite... You don't get the benefit. Like, I think ARMS and 1-2 Switch benefited from that because you're like...
So I mean, I guess, even say Xenoblade Chronicles 2 benefits from that as well.
I mean, you know, I'm not, yeah, I probably wouldn't, Golf Story? Yeah. I wouldn't disagree necessarily. I mean, that's the thing. Like, quite honestly, like, Xenoblade's success is a lot of it on Xenoblade 2, right? Like, that was a Switch year one game. And I think a lot of people who would not have picked up a game like that otherwise did. And that led to the growth of the series, right? Like, really, the current era of Xenoblade, why it has become a mainstay for Nintendo, is because of how successful the second game was on Switch, right? It sold really well, and it meant that they could greenlight sequels and continue to develop them, and, you know, it's now become a main franchise for them. So it's definitely something to think about, and I don't know, like, we're getting a sequel to Super Princess Peach, quote unquote, at the end of this Switch's life cycle. So that's one of those like unknown, forgotten IPs.
Is it actually a sequel to that game?
No, I don't think it is. But it's just, I mean,
it's
that's
just
how
a game that features Peach. Yeah,
right. That's how I'm framing it. Because there's only been one other game that features playable Princess Peach as the main protagonist. You can play as her in other games like Mario 2 and stuff. But you know, like, they've covered a lot of bases, and there's not a huge amount of stuff still coming. I mean, the main stuff that hasn't come is stuff that we've been waiting for multiple generations, so it's not like it's suddenly going to appear at the end of the Switch's life cycle.
We even
and be
did
like,
get Advance Wars, you know, like, that was... Yeah. That was, but no F-Zero, no Wave Race.
No Punch-Out either, which has been absent for a little while. I think Punch-Out's a good shout, potentially, because it is a... It's a bit of a simpler kind of style of game and has a little bit lower barrier to entry, potentially. So I wonder if that would be one that could still make it.
I don't think anything that we don't know about that is first-party Nintendo is coming. I think the time has passed. I think we're going to get Peach and potentially Metroid Prime 4. And I think then... the new system's going to launch. And I think that it feels like they're holding up dev teams, especially the 3D Mario team, to launch with a new thing. There's the potential the new system could launch with 3D Mario and Mario Kart, and that would just be like an ideal launch double, right?
Do you not think that, like, what we have seen is, okay, there's going to be another WarioWare game? Do you not think there's the potential for, one more Mario Party, here's one more, you know, something that has already come to the system?
I think you're right on, like, Mario Party or Mario Sports game or Kirby game, because there's
of
so
course,
many
there
of
will be a Kirby game. Take it to the bank, yeah. Like,
and let's
guaranteed.
Say, so when do you think this Switch 2 is going to come out? We're thinking, like, October next year?
Yeah, I mean... I think there's a chance for it to be slightly earlier than that. I don't think May. Like, if we're talking late 24, right, then obviously it has to be any time past March of the fiscal year, right?
Right.
So I think, like, September is probably the earliest it comes, I would imagine. Like, November is a traditional console launch month. It always has been. And Nintendo haven't been in that cycle for a while because Switch was a March launch, and I guess Wii U was a November launch. I remember getting that in November. So
I think I'm going with October, I think, because it gets everything flowing before that November hype train
and Thanksgiving and everything, Black Friday, right?
Black Friday, right? Exactly.
Yeah, that probably makes some sense.
Mario Odyssey came out October.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. It's definitely possible, and I don't know, there's still a possibility that it comes out early 2025 instead. You know, the thing is with Nintendo rumors is nothing is set in stone.
We forget how long the rumor mill was for the Switch. Even though Nintendo was in more dire need of it with the Wii U, that rumor mill felt like it went on for over 2 years. Like,
it did, because
it really did.
Nintendo started the rumor mill because they came out because the Wii U was doing so badly. They were like, NX is a thing. And people were like, what? NX, okay. So Nintendo, like, said to their shareholders, like, our new system is codenamed this and it's going to come eventually way earlier than they usually would have done, because they were in dire need of doing that, because otherwise people were going to stop investing in them leaving them behind. So they kind of had
one thing that's not confirmed in the rumors is backwards compatibility.
Yes.
I would bet my house that it will be backwards compatible for two reasons.
Okay.
One, Nintendo always make the successor to really successful systems backwards compatible. So the successor to the Wii U was backwards compatible. The successor to the DS, 3DS was backwards compatible. But on top of those successful systems, I think they have a really good track record of making handhelds backwards compatible.
That's true, yeah.
When you think about Game Boy, Game Boy Color, Game Boy Color, Game Boy Advance, Game Boy Advance to DS, DS to 3DS, all of those had like a lineage of backwards compatibility. And it was only the 3DS to the Switch, which is obviously a very strange jump, that hasn't really made it. So like the fact that Switch has sold so well, and that these rumors corroborate the cartridge system, I'd be shocked if there's not backwards compatibility. Now, if your games can seamlessly transition over is another question, but I think, will you be able to put your cartridges of your Switch games into the successor? I'm very confident you will be able to.
I think we could have a similar situation to 3DS and DS, where Switch Switch 2 cartridges just have a little tab on them instead.
Just that tab. Just yeah. That tab.
Which basically makes it so that you can't accidentally put them in an old Switch.
I think that's what they did on the Super Nintendo as well, between regions, I want to say.
Oh, interesting.
I remember someone saying you can like shave off either the European or North American, I can't remember which one,
yes.
And then it'll work on the other one, and it's just
right.
Mad.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, I think that definitely makes some sense. There's an argument to be made of like leaving everything behind so that you force people to buy new stuff. But I feel like Nintendo has such a giant ecosystem, and the world is just a different place now, right? Like everybody in a modern era expects, with Apple devices, with all the other platforms and consoles, there is a broad expectation to keep your stuff onto the next platform. And it's a retention mechanic as well, right? Because as we've talked about with the Phil Spencer stuff in the past, where he's like, well, we lost that generation because that was the one where everyone made their accounts and they had their libraries.
But this is Nintendo.
I know, and that's the thing that holds
like
me back.
Like when you bought your OLED MBZ and you wanted all your playtime to carry over from all those millions of Switch games you've played, and then it didn't.
Nope, it didn't. And so that is the one thing that always gives me pause is, with everything that we say, we must remember this is Nintendo. They are lunatics, and you know, I think someone recently was saying like no analyst has made money from predicting Nintendo just because it's just fucking impossible. They will do the leftist turn.
They just make decisions in their own little bubble.
Oh, of course. Wow. And like, as much as the world has moved on and everyone understands account systems and carrying things forward, and you know, if you buy a new phone, you can just transfer everything across and you keep all your old things and it's fine. Nintendo and Nintendo. And so they may very well be like, nope, you're going to restart all over again. And I'm really fascinated to see how people would react to that, especially a lot of normies out there who just bought Switch. Because, I mean, it's sold 130 million copies already, or units. Yeah. The latest financials came out as well, right? And like Mario Kart is past like 55 million. Every game is selling stupid numbers. Tears of the Kingdom already at 18 fucking million copies in like a handful of months, which is astronomical. So what I'm saying is a lot of regular people out there who are buying Switch, and I think they're gonna probably soon find out that Nintendo are a fucking weird company if they decide we're not gonna carry anything forward. Hey, buy all your games again. I think the one thing that gives me a little pause on that is that Furukawa did say, hey, we are planning to carry forward this Nintendo account system. Now a lot of people are reading into that and being like, great, this means I'm gonna download all my games. No, that's not what that means. That just means that the thing you use to log in to your Nintendo account right now, you'll be able to use it to log in to the next system. Mm. Whether that means your purchases will be available, or that they know about your purchases, and we know this because they've done transfers.
Exactly. You might even have a list on your new system of all your previous purchases, but it won't let you download them.
Yes. No, and I absolutely believe Nintendo would do that as well, right?
Yeah.
But there is that shining light of like, Furukawa said, hey, we're planning to keep these people. And, you know, it makes sense if you have a subscription business to say, hey, we have subscribers to this thing. We should probably keep those subscribers subscribed to that thing, which is another thing to discuss of like, every time we talk about virtual console stuff, me and you are like, we've been around the block like five times now. We know that they're going to be like, And hey, guys, Super Mario Brothers, it's here. Are you so excited? You could play Mario 3. And we're going to be like, you fucking, why would you do this every single time?
Okay, okay.
Let's start again from the beginning.
There is a caveat this time. And this is, the caveat is, that this is the first time they've had a subscription. So.
Yes, that's true.
I would really question, and I wouldn't put it past them, like you've suggested. Like, I think that there's every chance that they roll out a new subscription service, which is separate entirely. and then, as you say, they roll out Mario Brothers 3. Here you go for the month of February. Mm-hmm. Get excited. And yep. Yeah, there's every chance they do a new subscription service. But, God, please carry over the subscription service. Like, yeah. Come on. Like, I don't know. That would yeah. be...
It's not going to shock me if they even come out and are like, Nintendo Switch Online NES games are coming to Switch 2. And the first 10 games are fucking, what's the one? Duck Hunt and Mario Brothers 1 and Ice Climber. And then they slowly roll out every game again on that same fucking app.
Yeah, and this is, meanwhile, the only online game on Switch 2 to play with everyone is the launch Mario Kart game. And there's nothing else to play online. So you're paying this, like, I don't know. How much is it, like 25 quid a year or something?
Just 30, 35 if you want to do the expansion pass.
Expansion.
But,
yeah, exactly.
Well, that's a good point, isn't it, right? Like, if they want to retain expansion pass members, they can't just start with NES games. They have to have something else for people. So that's a really interesting idea, right? Like, the existence of the expansion pass maybe, like, gives us some hope that we aren't going to restart, because Nintendo don't want to lose £35 a year from you.
They equally don't want to launch with something spicy that takes limelight away from their launch games. And I would argue to a fairly hardcore Nintendo audience, like many listeners of this show, I think launching with something like a GameCube library would potentially make enough waves that they would be reticent to do it. And, but you know, like, they want to focus all their energy on Mario Kart and the 3D Mario game at launch. They don't want to start talking about, like, GameCube Virtual Console on their Nintendo Online system. They want to just focus on those two games. So I think even if you got something as good as, like, GameCube, it would be down the line. And you have to remember, like, Nintendo have already made a lot of money from remaking, not even just porting, well, remaking in some ways is debatable with Metroid Prime, for example, but porting Super Mario Sunshine as part of the 3D Mario collection. And, you know,
there's a bunch of other GameCube games on Switch as well from other publishers, right?
Plus, like, there's Pikmin 1 and 2 that they've just done this year. So, like, they are porting Nintendo GameCube games still at this point, where, I don't know, maybe those ports now mean that they can actually accept that they made some money off of the GameCube Virtual Console, well, off of porting GameCube games, and now they can actually put them out on an online service. Who knows? I don't know. It's just, if you take all of the negative things, I think those are the things Nintendo will keep about the new system, including stuff like Joy-Cons, for example, with Joy-Con Drift, and, like, who knows what they're going to do in terms of that question. That's another question that you've answered. And then they'll throw away all the good stuff, like a large video game library on the Switch Online service, for example. Like, I just think, I think there's going to be lots of good about this new system, but like everything else, there'll be something that drives us mad. A bit like Nintendo Switch without having, like, a soulless shop and a soulless menu, stuff like that. Yes. Like, stuff like that really annoys Nintendo fans. It's not hard to do, but Nintendo.
No, we're easily triggered.
We're very easily triggered.
Okay, so, like, from an OS perspective, number one, do we get themes that are not just black and white? Number two, do we get an eShop that has any sense of life or vibe to it, or any sense of discoverability at all, so you can find any games?
I think on themes, if we're getting them, it's not for, like, 2 years in. Like, 3DS themes, when did they come in?
I feel like they weren't that soon. I mean, the thing is, 3DS was so busted at launch, it didn't even have an eShop. We had to wait 3 months for the eShop to exist on 3DS.
Right,
so,
exactly. But I feel like themes came in, like, 3 years after launch or something crazy. It was a long time.
Yeah.
I'm confident the shop will have energy day one.
Okay. And number three... will they have a solution that isn't telling you the nearest fucking 5 hours you've played a video game?
Does the activity log make a return?
Honestly, I would
sacrifice so many of these other issues if we could have the damn activity log back. My God.
If they bring back the activity log, I will forgive everything Nintendo has ever done. It is literally the best thing they have ever made. Like, forget fucking Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom.
It's so good. It's got its own charm, its own design, its own, like, music. It's so meticulously crafted, and you can look at bar charts, you can look at month, you can look at day, you can look at year, you can arrange them in most played to least played with the specific hour counts. It's to the minute. It was insanely good. To the point where I would check in with it almost after every game session just to see,
yes,
oh, how much more Samus Returns have I played? Is it number 20 yet? And it would just work its way up. Oh, I loved it so much.
The stupidest thing about the activity log that I think shows how on the money it was is that the activity log counted how much time you had spent looking at the activity log.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah. It made it into my top 20.
Absolutely. My activity log was like my top 10 game on the fucking system because of the amount of time I spent looking at it. Insane. It's like, it count how long you spent browsing the eShop, for God's sake. Like, it was so comprehensive as an idea, and like the very notion that they've just gone backwards from that, it depresses me. They had perfection. They said, nah, let's get rid of that. Really sucks. So,
but it is exciting. Like, these rumors are here and the rumor mill can start. And I'm sure between now and the end of the year, the start of next year, we're going to get like little tidbits here and there.
When do we start hearing about this thing? I think that's the question, right? Because if we have until late 2024, I feel like whatever Nintendo Direct happens later this year is probably still going to show us Switch stuff for the rest of 24, maybe filling out a little bit of the lineup.
I believe with the Switch, that initial trailer where the dude's playing Breath of the Wild and then takes his dog out for the walk, that was the first reveal of the Nintendo Switch ever.
Yes.
I want to say that was in like September 2016.
It was October.
October 2016. Yep. So then you had the few months and then the big Tokyo on stage E3 style show was January 2017.
Yes, that's correct.
And that was like ARMS and the most incredible Zelda trailer of all time. And we came away from that one a bit lukewarm. And then the system launched in May.
March,
sorry.
It was the 3rd of March. March 3rd. So it was 5-month turnaround from first trailer to release.
Which is kind of wild considering how long the initial rumor cycle was. Like we were saying, it was like for 2 years. So
it's why people were losing their minds so much, right? Nintendo tweeted out that image of Mario behind the curtain, the internet was just frothing. It was just like unhinged shit.
If I think we see this thing before the end of the fiscal year to get the shareholders excited. Like, I think we see it between January and March 2024.
That's a really interesting idea.
And then I think shareholders go, ooh, it looks like the Switch, it'll sell really well. They're all happy. And then Nintendo do a big old direct in, I don't know, June, July. And then the thing comes out September, October.
Yeah.
Like, that's
I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if they held it until the summer and did what they did with Switch, which is just like a few months turnaround. And they can afford to do it even more so now than back then, because they have tended to, and you know, there's exceptions, Metro Prime 4 still hanging out there 6 years later.
Yeah, I'm still convinced that's coming to Switch 2 and not Switch, but perhaps they feel they have to honor their what they said. But
yeah, but like, you know, with most games now from Nintendo, they're like, by the way, Mario Wonder exists, it's coming out in like 5 months. You know, so I think like doing that with a system also viable, and you know, to the masses it doesn't matter that much because the masses won't start hearing about it until a month before it comes out usually. So for a broader audience, I think, you know, doing it around the June time, like similar time period to what they did this year, which is like wait for everyone else to do their E3 thing and then go out on your own and own the conversation. I think that's very viable and very possible. So, and I wonder if we start seeing some games that get announced around that period and we're like, that seems like it would be on a Nintendo system, but it doesn't get announced for Nintendo. And then they do the same thing they did this year where it's like, oh, by the way, it's coming here.
Yeah. What do you feel for launch lineup Is it looking like Mario Kart and 3D Mario?
I think that's safe. I think they would be lunatics not to launch with Mario Kart, given how fucking long it's been since a new one, and the success of the current one. Like, it makes sense. I think because the first year of Switch was so successful for them, they'll probably spread it out. So the question is, do they do 3D Mario at launch and then Mario Kart a couple of months later? I think that actually makes more sense, because you're guaranteed to get hardcore people day one, and you may want to get more momentum a little bit later into the year. So having Mario Kart be your November game, for example, you know, if you launch with a new 3D Mario and that's a launch title, and then the next month in November is Mario Kart, that probably makes a bit more sense, because that's the driving force for people to, more casual people, to buy the system, right?
Right, right.
That would make sense. In terms of what else, I don't know. Like, really, 3D Mario is the one thing that everyone's been clamoring for and feels very weird by its absence. I think, like, your kind of thing earlier this year, you talked about Metroid Prime 4 coming a little bit later in the system's life cycle. I think that makes sense as well, like a February, March 25.
It doesn't speak launch game at all, does it, Prime 4? Like, it's too niche.
Yeah, but like launch window, once they have a few systems under their belt and people hardcore are still clamoring for stuff, that's a good time to drop that as well.
Yeah.
But they also just want to make sure they're pacing themselves properly, because they don't want to shotgun burst every single big IP within a small period of time, and then you have a similar situation of the second year of Switch, where it's like Smash Brothers and Let's Go Pikachu, I guess, right? Like, that was kind of the lineup. So maybe better to hold things back a little bit.
Hey, Sakurai said he's up for more Smash. So
he says he's up for it. They haven't, haven't called him yet.
Don't let him.
Yeah, my goodness. That poor man, he just needs to retire. I mean, he's a YouTuber now. I don't think he makes games anymore. He just makes YouTube videos. He's having a good time. But it's exciting times. Finally, we're going to get there to a new system.
Yes. We will talk a lot about it between now and, I'm sure, every time a little bit of a rumor comes out. We're going to say something about it. But yeah, Dave97, you've started the ball rolling.
Mm-hmm.
The hype is building. Switch 2 coming next year.
Yeah.
Right. Let's move on to our next question, which is from Raf on Discord, who says, "We like to think of game series as just continuing on in perpetuity, but not every series is meant to last for decades on end, like Mario, Zelda, or Final Fantasy. A lot just fizzle out at some point. That being said, what are some new series of the past decade, let's say a series with three or fewer games, that you would like to see become regular, expected mainstays over the next 30 years of gaming?"
Yeah, this is really interesting, because when I started to think about this, I very quickly realized that there aren't a lot of things that qualify for this. I was looking at, like, hey, what are, like, the biggest games of the last decade? I'm like, these are all sequels to things that have existed beyond this decade. And I think that speaks to the weirdness of this decade in games, in that for a lot of the kind of bigger stuff, it is continuing on with franchises that have existed for a while. And there's some new stuff in there. But I think a lot of the new stuff, it doesn't come from places like Nintendo, it comes from other platforms. And the types of games that those are, I look at them and I'm like, no, I don't want to see this in another 30 years. I think that this should just stop after a few games and then be done. I mean, a good example is one of your favorite series, Bally, Horizon, where I'm like, I look at it, I'm like, no, like, I'm more like, I feel exhausted thinking about one more of these games, let alone 25 more. And I think Sony thinks the other direction, because they supposedly
Is that predominantly narrative reasons or gameplay mechanic reasons, or a bit of both?
I think the reason is it's the same video game every time. And I think the problem with, and this is the problem with a lot of modern games, is that they're like, we're an open world video game, and people just get fucking tired of it. Look at Far Cry, for God's sake. Far Cry is such a tired, overdone series. Like, it's the same
example.
Assassin's Creed is the same.
I mean, it's mixed it up a little more than Far Cry, maybe, but not
right.
Much.
And I think Final Fantasy is an excellent example here, because it's a great franchise that is so different every single time it comes out.
And Mario and Zelda, they fit that mold. Yeah,
exactly. I would say Zelda a little less so up until the recent shakeup, because you could argue that, you know, from Ocarina to Wind Waker to Twilight Princess to Skyward Sword, like, there's a framework and a structure there. But at least from a kind of visual aesthetic perspective, they always go in wild different directions, yeah. Which has always been one of my favorite things about the Zelda series. And Mario constantly is doing weird stuff, whether it's like new 2D games or the 3D games have two different splinters to them. There's also the isometric games with the 3D land, 3D world. So Mario has such variety, and also lots of spin-offs as well, which helps keep things fresh. I think that's the other thing, like Mario, Zelda, and Final Fantasy, they all have the core main series that are very different, but they also have a bunch of spin-offs that are very different as
they
well.
They started in the early 80s, I want to
say. Yeah, like, exactly. They all started in such different forms than they are now. And I look at modern games and I'm like, well, this is just going to be the same thing again. Like, they haven't shown a willingness to change, or what even they could change into, in a way that makes me not excited about them being around for 30 years. And honestly, just don't feel like they have the character or like the nature of being iconic to stay around for that long.
I think it's also an impossible question in the sense that if you'd asked us at the end of the 80s which franchises should stay around for the next 30 years, for the same reasons you're giving now, MBZ, we would argue that Mario should not return for the next 30 years, because Mario Brothers 1, 2, and 3, yes, they evolve and change a bit, but they're still iterative. And it's not until you see games like Yoshi's Island and Mario 64 and Sunshine and Galaxy that you realize, oh wow, Mario is a series that reinvents itself. You don't know that at the end of the 80s or the start of the 90s. So yeah. I think that, yes, there are lots of series that have started in this decade, but it's too early to tell whether we would want them around for the next 30 years, because we don't know how they would reinvent themselves.
That's true. I think the difference there is that we were so technologically inept back then that there was so much room and growth and possibility. And I feel like the space we're at in games right now, there is some innovation, but like, it's certainly not happening on a big scale. It's extremely marginal. And so I look at an open world game like Horizon, Ghost of Tsushima, all these types of games, and I'm like, well, like, what direction do you go in with these, really, right? Like, how do you keep this fresh and not sacrifice what the selling points of these games are, which is big, endless... Yeah, exactly. Big, endless, open worlds full of stuff. Now, Sony might have a different opinion, because it seems like they have like 11 Horizon projects in the works or something stupid. Like, that came out. And that's, I think that's across like all media, right? So it could be comic books and stuff like that, right? But that, I don't know. I look at a lot of those things and I think, how do they justify themselves continuing over that period of time? I'm not sure that they do. So, yeah, I think it's quite tricky. Were there any, Bally, that popped up for you of ones that you do think?
One series that is quite a bit older than 10 years old, so I'm cheating, because within the last 10 years, I think is really, really tough. A Nintendo franchise that we think has as much Nintendo energy as games like Zelda and Mario, that I would like to see for the next 30 years keep reinventing its formula and change stuff up, is definitely like Luigi's Mansion. Like, I think it can work really nicely as the slower, more methodical Luigi game to Mario's more audacious bouncing around game. And I think Luigi's Mansion 3 juxtaposes Odyssey really nicely, is what I'm trying to say. Like, it's a very different pace of game, but it allows that creativity, the Haunted Mansion creativity that Nintendo has, is a very different energy to what the way that you explore a world in, say, Mario Odyssey. And I think that that theory can change throughout the next 20, 30 years. Like, that, the idea that you have the faster paced jumping guy and the slower paced peek behind the curtain guy is a really strong duopoly that I think Nintendo should keep going with between Mario and Luigi for the next 30 years.
Yeah, I think it's maybe a struggle to think of how that would work, because to me at the moment, the name Luigi's Mansion in itself is a limiting factor, it feels like, just because it denotes that you must have a similar setting, a spooky horror kind of...
I mean, I think the mansion can be dropped from the name and it becomes Luigi's something.
Right, yeah, exactly. And I think that would be a good way forward, and that would... Yeah. That would work in the same way that we look at Zelda and Final Fantasy and Mario in the terms that they change every time in a different way, but still keep the heart of
it. And I don't think the hotel in 3 is a mansion.
Yeah, but it's still like the idea of a enclosed setting horror experience, right? Like a ghost's around the corner and he's a scaredy cat and he has to run away. And I think you can still get Luigi's personality in there without having a kind of horror tinge setting and kind of building out that way. That would probably be the best approach to do it, I think, to make it something that continues and stays on. But I don't know, the way this question is phrased almost feels like Luigi is part of Mario, right? When you're saying like Mario, Zelda, and Final Fantasy, I almost think of them as like giant sub brands underneath which
it's a sub Mario brand for sure.
You can kind of put things. I think the thing is, like, you don't really have many of those giant sub brands anymore, you know, or giant brands that then spawn sub things.
Nintendo's lucky to have lots of them versus other companies.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe, you know, maybe Horizon will be the next Mario. Who could say? But I don't have a lot of hope that's going to be the case. I think one for me that doesn't really, again, it's hard to like, this decade's been weird, so it's difficult to stay within those bounds. But a game that, or series that Nintendo has, that has reinvented itself pretty much every time, but has barely had any entries, is Kid Icarus, which has a weird NES game, a Game Boy game that's somewhat similar but is different, and then the 3DS game that's just a totally different genre and style and space. And I think what Sakurai did with Uprising was he opened the door to make this series be whatever it wants to be, essentially. And I think that's freeing, because it means whatever the next Kid Icarus game is, it doesn't have to abide by any rules. It can kind of go in whatever direction it wants to, whether it wants to stick with the kind of Star Fox-esque flying things mixed with the on-ground kind of combat sequences, or if it wants to go in another direction that kind of hones into another aspect of the character, you know, like, I mean, Kid Icarus honestly has some of the best writing in any Nintendo game, and like its chops are almost like visual novel worthy. Like, you could see an entire kind of narrative game built around Kid Icarus. I think there's a lot of flexibility to that franchise and what the life that it was injected with when Sora and Sakurai kind of took it over. That I'd be really interested to see some more regular entries in that series, and give them to interesting developers and see what they make. And I think there's a lot of life in that as an idea, despite having a big long gap from like the origin point to the most recent entry, which at this point, that recent entry is almost a decade old now. So
that is wild.
We're getting on in time. That one's pretty good. I feel like one that I want to be better than it is Splatoon, in that it has three games. They're all very much the same thing. And, like, I really want it to be a Mario or Zelda where every release is very different. But when you're a multiplayer game, it's so much harder to do that because you are constrained to what the core fan base wants, right? Yeah. Which is, like, these core mechanics again and again.
What do all the biggest multiplayer, and we can say shooters, I guess, what do all the biggest multiplayer shooters look like in 30 years? Like, does Call of Duty exist in 30 years?
I think it does. It's too much of a juggernaut to not.
And does it just look the same as now, but prettier? You know, like, is it probably mechanically more or less the same?
If you look at it over the last 15 years, that's what it is. You know, like, it hasn't changed in 15 years. So do we think it's going to change in 30? I don't really think so. I mean, it depends if there's...
And I'm sure there will be another few wars in the world by 20 and 30 years time that they can reference and make games out of. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, you know,
it's a factory, it's a farm, right? Like, has FIFA changed in the last 20 years? Not really. Like, it's just the same thing.
Change its name.
Yeah, it does. Oh God. I'm very interested to see how that goes. But I do think that stuff like that, makes it hard, but I've railed again and again on this show about, like, give me weird Splatoon games. Give me a fashion spin-off. Give me, like, a strange, like, unique genre mashup with Splatoon. Because, like, the world and the universe is so cool and it has such a vibe to it. And they can do so many weird and interesting things, right? Like, talk about Vemba, weird cooking game in this episode. Make a weird Splatoon cooking game. You could do that. Yeah. You know, you could do cool stuff in that space. And I think that it is rife for exploration, you know? Like, I feel... what it did with its single player in 3 sets it up to have a potential, like, platforming adventure with Splatoon, where you are using those mechanics in a more Mario fashion, where it's much more about the platforming challenge than the combat of it. And I think that would be super interesting. You know, there's directions you can take that series in a 2D landscape as well. Imagine a 2D Splatoon game, like a side-scrolling Splatoon 2D game would be a great idea. And I think Nintendo, with their propensity to make 2D versions of games still, are one of those companies who would do an idea like that. And I think they would do it really well. So,
you know, the mechanic in Mario Odyssey of like jumping into a pipe and you become 2D and you go in there in the wall.
Yeah.
Like, I'm super shocked that's not been played with in any Splatoon game in a similar way, where if you're inking yourself into a wall and you're going across, like, why doesn't that wall become a 2D game in a Splatoon setting, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It works amazing for Mario with the pipe and Odyssey. I love it. It works fantastic. But there's definitely... Yeah, the world of Splatoon is incredible, and more ideas need to happen there. And it's a little bit of a shame how similar Splatoon 3 is to Splatoon 1, at purely like mechanical level, even though 3 is a fantastic game with an amazing single-player campaign we've talked about. But like... yeah, there's room to do things in that world, and want to see them do it. I'd argue you could even, it's a lot less of a fleshed out world, but it was a really cool world, was ARMS. And like, just what's the background on those characters? How does it work? Like, Nintendo are great at creating these worlds and characters. And yeah, sometimes when a series doesn't do that well, like ARMS, we might not ever see an ARMS game again. And that's a shame. I'd even throw in that argument for F-Zero, with a fantastic cast of characters that we know. Well, there was the comics, and then there's been a few games, and GX had an interesting story mode, but it's like, you could do so much with those characters, like an F-Zero fighting game, you know? Like, there's ways
hell
of
reinventing
that world.
And, oh my god, dude.
Yeah, I don't know, just... It's nice that Zelda and Mario get this crazy reinvented treatment every time, but like, they can totally be bold and try it with other areas.
Yeah, for sure. I think slightly outside the Nintendo realm, but technically it's still on a Nintendo platform, so it counts. And probably because I've been playing a lot of it recently, the new kind of story stuff in Overwatch 2 makes me like really think that if they hadn't bungled this sequel so much, that they have a thing that could last 30. Like, Overwatch is so iconic in a lot of ways, and the characters, the world of it, like the storytelling they've done outside of the game, there's so much scope for variety with all the characters and all the mechanics that each of them has for like 20 different games, right? You could do so much different stuff with that universe. Like, it's ripe for experimentation and weird spin-offs and unique side games. And like, the core of it is still like, hey, this is a shooter and a kind of team-based thing. But I feel like you could evolve that in a lot of different areas and make it something that lives, because it has, to me, it has the iconic status and feels like it should be a mainstay over the next 30 years, if not for the way that they've bungled it in a variety of ways. But, you know, it's like the taste I have now of those story missions. I'm like, this is really cool. Like, why is there not a whole single player Overwatch game like this? Like, it would have been so good, and they just haven't done it. And I think that's a real shame, because yeah, that's a thing that I think is super cool, that could have been one of the greats. And I don't know if it will end up being that, if it will survive the next 30 years.
When this podcast is still going in 30 years, can someone write in and remind us, and we can cover this
conversation? We can double check and see if Overwatch still exists in 30 years.
Yeah, we can see, is Call of Duty still what it is?
The same game.
Is still going? Are Mario and Zelda still redefining the industry 30 years on? Like, I want to know.
Yeah, absolutely. So put a note in your diary for 2053.
I'll also be 62, but other than that, I'm sure...
Don't say that. Oh my Jesus Christ. Okay, cool. Life didn't flash before my eyes there or anything. No, I'm fine. I'm all good. Cool.
But yeah, thank you very much for your question, Raph. That's a real thinker in the end.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, for sure. Good.
It's nice.
Lovely. Well, I think that's going to close us out. Bally, if people want to send their emails into us, where can they do that?
Please email thisnintendolife@gmail.com. That is thisnintendolife@gmail.com. And like I said at the top of the segment, we've got a channel in our Discord server. You can leave a question, a comment, over there. The channel is called Emails.
Absolutely. So get over there and get writing, send us some stuff. Always appreciate hearing and hearing from new people as well. So if you've not written in before, always a good thing to do. As mentioned at the top of the show, next time in 2 weeks, we will have a different episode. It will be Metro Prime Federation Force, the ultimate special, featuring a friend of the show, Matt Lorigan. A great conversation, and please do listen to it. Even if you haven't played Federation Force, I think it's really worth hearing, and it may convince you to pick up the game. I think at this point you'd have to get it from a secondhand shop, because unfortunately you can't buy it from the eShop anymore, because Nintendo closed it down. But the online still works for it, and so if you're able to get a group of people together, it's well worth playing. And we'll elaborate it on in that episode. But do get listening to that next time, and then we'll be back with another regular episode after I'm back from Germany and all that stuff is done. So looking forward to it. It'll give Bally some time to maybe finish Pikmin in the meanwhile. Yeah, get ready for Mario Wonder coming in October, right? That's October.
October 20th, the same day as Spider-Man 2, and 10 days after Forza Motorsport.
It's all happening.
There's no number. It's just Forza Motorsport.
Yeah. It is all happening, and it will continue to happen, and you can continue to follow us as it's happening by going to places on the internet to find us. You can find me on Twitter, at LordMBZ. Where can they find you, Bally?
I'm on Twitter at Ballyman91, that's BallyMan91.
Fantastic. You can also find me on Threads at LordMBZ. You can also find me on Blue Sky now. I'm now there also, even though... I don't know. I feel like Blue Sky is such a members club that I don't know anyone on there because it's so closed off. So I'm like, cool, I guess. The thing is with Blue Sky, here's the thing, Bally. I got at NBZ. I'm at NBZ. What? I didn't even get Lord NBZ. Wow. I got NBZ. Wow. So... Fucking first time in my
life.
There's
no way I'd be able to get Bally at Bally.
Yeah.
There's the gyms, there's this fashion brand, there's... I could try.
Too popular. I don't know, if you're on Blue Sky, you have to be a cool person to be on there, and I don't know, it's very difficult. I hope they open that up to more people, and then I might start using it, but I don't know. I don't really know what to do right now, because I can't really find anybody, so... But yeah, you can follow on various social platforms. And you can also follow the show at TNL Podcast on Twitter as well, for updates about everything that we are doing. You can find the show in various places on the internet, such as Spotify and Stitcher, and you can download us wherever good podcasts are sold. You can, however, also support us directly monetarily by going over to patreon.com/thisNintendoLife, and you can get some bonus stuff, some bonus episodes. Bally would like to thank some of our patrons.
Yes, thank you to our $10 tier plus patrons. They are Zach S., Thomas, Matthew, Albert, Wicked Gamer UK, Alan, and Turtle. Thank you all for your $10 tier plus support, but thank you also to all of our other patrons. We really, really, really appreciate the support you give the show, to make a couple of different Patreon shows. You know, we've got bonus bits, we've got this non-tender life, we talk about non-tender games, and I think for this upcoming bonus bits, we're gonna do some Barbie film spoilers. I didn't think I'd say that in 2023.
And also on the $5 tier, we upload random stuff, which will include my Gamescom vlog, not vlog, audio log. I'll take an audio log at Gamescom, basically.
NBZ's Californian one that was very good. I'd highly recommend checking that out if you want to support us for $5.
I'll put up the Gamescom one when I get back from that.
But maybe don't listen to it if you're from LA. That's my warning.
Also, I'll be nice to the Germans. It's fine. They're cool.
Oh, they're great. They're so nice back.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll probably talk about sausages and various foods over there. So stay tuned for that. That is going to do us for now. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back very soon with some more Nintendo chatter. Until then, bye-bye, everyone. See ya. Musical interlude used on today's show was Ne Dane from Venba, copyright Visai Games 2023.